I'm going to be speaking to Stephen Meichild, who spent time with notorious serial killer Ted Bundy. A fascinating insight into the mind of America's most serious, most notorious serial killer.
This is Timothy Spall, and you're listening to Giles Brown on TRE.
You're listening to Giles Brown on TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain. Ted Bundy was America's first celebrity serial killer and one of the most chilling enigmas in criminal history. Handsome, boyish, and well-spoken, a law student with bright political prospects, Bundy was also a predator and a sexual deviant who murdered and mutilated more than 30 young women and girls, many of them college co-eds, but at least two as young as 12. Penned by two journalists in close contact with Bundy's friends and relatives, as well as spending 150 hours interviewing him on death row, Ted Bundy, the only living witness, is a definitive account of America's most notorious criminal, as told by the people who knew him best. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from Texas, I believe. Stephen Michaud, one of the writers of Ted Bundy, only living witness. Stephen, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon to you. Good to hear you.
Good to have you with us. Just give me a little rundown. I mean, most people will know the name Ted Bundy, but just explain what time period we're talking here and a little bit about his background.
Ted was born in 1946 in a home for unwed mothers, which we used to have here in the States. And his mother Louise tried to leave him there, and her father, Ted's grandfather, said, "No, you're taking the boy home." So he was raised without a father until he was about five, and then his mother moved from her home on the east coast of the United States to Tacoma, Washington, which coincidentally is where I grew up. And Ted had an outwardly very normal childhood. Nothing that alarmed anybody too terribly much. But when he reached puberty, there were some very serious changes that started going on inside of him. And by the time he was in his 20s, he was stalking and attacking and then eventually murdering young women whom he would take out into the forest and kill and dismember. And then, if the opportunity allowed, he would have postpartum sex with them. That's the 5-minute tour of Ted Bundy.
Quite horrendous. But I mean, again, we seem to think that serial killers are all loners. They're all deranged. I mean, Ted Bundy, a law student, you know, seeming to go well on the surface. You know, highly intelligent man. Everything going for him. Not a bad looking guy either.
No, absolutely true. One of the things that Ted disproved for all time was that you can spot somebody who's capable of the horrendous crimes that he committed by just looking at him or talking to them or watching them, and that's simply not true. Ted was an entirely credible human being, with lots of very starchy Republican friends and pretty girls who wanted nothing more than to be with him. I spent a lot of time with him, and I can tell you that he was articulate, he was intelligent, introspective, which was sort of a surprise to me. But in the end, probably the most interesting thing about Ted that I discovered was that he had no clue as to why he did it. All he knew is that he really enjoyed it and wanted to do it for as long as he could.
Which, in its own way, is perhaps even more chilling than the drooling maniac that we may associate with a serial killer. Somebody who...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, because he's undetectable. The other key, Ted, that was original to him was traveling long distances in his VW Bug between crimes. Ted discovered that you could move unseen through malls and gas stations and cafes all over the United States, especially the Western United States, and nobody would remember you. Nobody would remember seeing you, and so he was able to commit these anonymous crimes with no witnesses. And of course, the police departments in these various jurisdictions did not cooperate with one another. And so he had discovered an MO, if you will, that was almost foolproof.
Mm. What particular time period? Is this late 70s to early 80s, if my memory serves me correctly?
Well, born in 46, so in his first murder that is known is 1973.
Right.
He was arrested in 1975 on a traffic stop for the first time, escaped a couple of times, committed some more murders, and was finally brought into custody for the last time in Pensacola, Florida in 1978, late in the year.
And obviously, this was, as they say in the book, he was America's first celebrity serial killer. And I suppose that in an age of those 24/7 news and social media, and everybody wants their 5 minutes of fame, no matter how twisted it is, Ted Bundy really set the template for notoriety.
He sure did. The term serial killer wasn't even current at the time that he started out. There certainly had been serial killers in the United States before him. And when I say serial, I mean someone who kills and stops and then kills again and kills until he is stopped, rather than like a mass killer where everybody gets killed at once.
Mm.
But he... You know, he was such an enigma to people, and he exuded this kind of fascinating charm, and it was very hard for people to reconcile his appearance and demeanor with what he had been accused of doing, and in the end, of course, confessed to doing, at least in part. And to this day, The people have not resolved themselves, particularly women, to the gap between perception and reality with Ted. And as you pointed out, it's very unnerving to have, you know, to know that if you say you're a young woman with your friends at a bar somewhere, and a very handsome, well-dressed, well-spoken individual asks you to dance or whatever, could very possibly have in his mind something very, very different, and you can't detect it.
You talk about serial killers as opposed to mass killers, and I'm just thinking about things like Zodiac, the Zodiac killer in San Francisco in the late 60s, and Son of Sam as well. Uh-huh. in New York. Was it Son of Sam? And there was a feeling, especially the Zodiac killers, of gripping the nation, of nobody wanted to go out because they were frightened. Did Bundy have the same effect? Did people know that there was a killer out there making his way, making a horrible progress through these states? Or was it, did the dots not join up until he was arrested and confessed?
Well, at the start, the various police agencies in the northwest of the United States did their best to ignore what was going on. You know, the concept of a serial killer, somebody who silently undetected grabs young women and they just disappear, which was the way it started. The police detectives were trained, and they still are around the world, that if you have a murder, you look first of all at the relatives or the people that the victim knew. I mean, that makes sense. Well, Ted didn't know any of his victims. They were all complete strangers. What they had in common was that they tended to be attractive, young, college-age, but in some cases younger, women. So it was, for a while at least, and by a while I mean several months, that the police could could believe that no such thing as a serial killer was happening to them. It was after he was caught and they started putting together the pieces that the portrait of a killer came together. And with every revelation, the possibility of Ted being good for 10, 20, 30, and in some guesses, more than 100 victims was really chilling, because anybody who looked at it rationally critically would say, can't we stop people like this? I mean, you know, how did he do it? How did he get away with it? And that's what we've been talking about here today, is that there are lots of ways to get away with it, and that's what Ted did.
So how did you end up sitting face-to-face with America's most notorious serial killer?
Well, that was a very strange story. I was working for Business Week magazine in New York in 1978, and I was getting ready to move to Japan for the magazine when my agent called me one day and said that this alleged serial killer, Ted Bundy, who at that point was in jail, in Florida, was reaching out, wanting to talk to a journalist about what really had happened to him, what he had done, in exchange for a re-examination of the cases against him, because Ted, at that point, was still swearing he was, quote, totally innocent. So I said, well, you know, this is interesting. I don't believe he's innocent, but on the chance that I, you know, that he is, he's telling the truth, I'll go down to Florida and interview him and see what he has to say. And I called up my old friend Hugh Ainsworth from my earlier days, who was then in Houston, and I said, why don't you go start doing this reinvestigation and I'll go talk to Ted? And so that's how it all began.
Is it difficult? Because you will have done your research and you will have done, and you told us at the beginning of the interview quite graphically about the fact that, you know, he killed, he murdered, he mutilated, he sexually abused after their deaths his victims. Is it difficult to sit down before somebody walks into a room like that and collect your thoughts and look dispassionately at somebody who you're going to be interviewing?
Well, I'll tell you what, you're absolutely right. And it was, on one important level, I was completely unprepared for it because I didn't know what psychopathy was or sociopathy. He was so credible. He was so personable. And so to talk to him and say, you know, and know what I knew about him, it was, I had this kind of undigested liberal point of view, I guess, that he could not have wanted to do what he did. He must be in the grasp of some sort of compulsion that he cannot control. And I was right on one level in that it was a compulsion that drove him, but he didn't want to control it. All he wanted to do was guide it so he could continue to do it. The other challenge I had with him was that he would not, despite what he had, the assurances he had given me through intermediaries, he wouldn't talk substantively about the cases. And so what I had to do was, in the end, take a big risk and say, okay, Ted, why don't we talk about what you know about the cases. You're the most knowledgeable person because you've been a suspect in all of the cases, that you have a background in psychology, and you have been to every crime scene with the police. They've taken you there. And to my surprise, I suppose, he grabbed my tape recorder and closed his eyes and just started talking about, at first I didn't even know what he was talking about, but it was basically the themes of violence in modern society that, at least for sex, can have a really negative impact on certain susceptible people, meaning Ted Bundy. And so off we went for 6 months, him talking about this person or this entity, as he called him, in the third person. And I just changed the tapes and lit his cigarettes for him and asked the question every now and again. It was 6 months of a 6 month course in serial murder with Ted teaching the class.
Chilling. And sort of mid-70s, late-70s, period of America reflecting upon itself. Was Bundy seeing himself as a cipher for the American experience then, talking about sex, the pressures of life in general? Was this appealing to his, he saw himself as a symbol, if you like, of what was wrong or what was happening to America, full stop?
Well, yeah, in a way it was, you know, it was his excuse. that, you know, but on another level, as I said earlier, Ted did not understand what was happening to him. And he, you know, we talked and talked and talked about, well, you know, what drives this sort of person and this and that. And at one point, you know, he said, well, this is the sort of person that had he been raised in a more restrictive, confined in culture, say Soviet Russia or perhaps Victorian England, he might have been a demon stamp collector. It just happens that he was raised in contemporary America with all of this violence and sex all around him, and that's what he absorbed. Now, and then the with that, of course, is this unexplainable predilection to do it in the first place, because, you know, it was a long, long process, as he described it, from looking at girls in magazines to fantasizing. The fantasy was always important, to actually beginning to act out on his fantasies, and then to sort of do themes and variations. What will I do next? Because, you know, they never are able to exactly recreate the fantasy with a crime. It's what drives these guys. And you could look at it in some ways as a string of failures, because he never succeeds in getting exactly what he wants. And that's what drives him to continue doing it until he's caught.
How do you...
How
do you, as a journalist and as a dispassionate listener, apart from listening to his justification in the third person, you turn off the tape, he gets escorted presumably back to his cell, you have to go home and process and digest and perhaps play back those tapes and make notes. Does it not completely have a profound effect on how you're viewing your world in the time you're with him and echoes of that following afterwards?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Ted left the stain on me, and it's never gone away. It was a little bit like watching a shark on the other side of an aquarium under glass. I knew that I was in no physical danger, because Ted only hit women over the head with sticks. He didn't attack males. It was nerve-wracking being in the prison, because he was talking about this stuff, and I didn't know if they were taping, you know, we were secretly being tape recorded or what. And I had to tell a couple of lies to get in there to talk to him in the first place. I remember the prison is out in the middle of nowhere, and, you know, that my diet when I was out there for 5 or 6 days at a time was scotch and cheeseburgers, and then going back to this motel room at night, listening to the tapes and trying to work out some kind of idea what I was going to do the next day, knowing full well that whatever I wanted to do would be blown up, and we would go wherever Ted wanted to go the next time I saw him. It was the only structure in these interviews was me trying to keep up with his, you know, he was going all over the place. He was not easy to follow.
At the same time, you know, Ted's talking in abstracts about, you know, his, why he's doing this, his compulsion. At the same time, you are aware of the way that these girls, these young women, and two cases, 12-year-olds died. Is that not hard for you not to, again, in with your cheeseburger and your scotch after these interviews, go, this is absolutely crazy?
Well, yeah, beyond crazy. And you remember that the only person with whom I could communicate, and that was only occasionally, was with Hugh Ainsworth. I couldn't tell a soul what was going on. So I was out there in the middle of nowhere communicating through, you know, when I could with Hugh in telephone booths, no cell phones. And he was wandering around out in the West, you know, trying to do the investigation. And it was very hard to articulate to him what was going on, because I was sort of in, the story was unfolding right before me, and what I might have to say about it on Wednesday would be canceled by what I learned from him on Thursday, if you know what I mean. It was a very, very isolating time. I mean, Ted and I sort of occupied the same little bubble together, literally and figuratively, until I finally said, that's enough, I won't do it anymore, and told Hugh to go to Florida and finish up.
I was going to say, you know, who had the last say, but it was you, because he presumably could have gone on with this for as long as he wanted to, and you just thought, that's, you know, as we say in Spain, basta, that's enough. You know, I can't do any more of this, or we have everything we need.
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, there was part of me that professionally said, God, I've got to keep after this. I have to keep after this. And there was part of me emotionally and personally saying, I better not keep up with this. To this day, I don't pretend to say I can explain Ted Bundy, but I say that with a certain amount of pride, because if I could, I'd be in trouble, I think.
Indeed. Did you ever, I mean, is there a lot, I mean, in all great Hollywood blockbusters, there's a last word or something, or was it just as mundane and inexplicable, you just walked away one day, or he just walked away one day and you didn't speak again?
Basically, I said, okay, I had an editor in New York who was saying, well, why don't I hear from you except when you want money? Which is every editor's complaint, as you know. But I had reached my tolerance. I couldn't think of anything else to do to pry more information out of Ted. And as you say, he once we got into this, he got really comfortable with it, because he was able to basically tell the story without feeling that he was jeopardizing himself legally, because the whole thing was conducted in the third person. And I could tell, or I discovered, that Bundy was really eager to talk about it, to talk to somebody about, you know, what it was like, to speculate about how it happened, all the considerations, what goes through your mind when you're a serial killer. How do you prioritize your time? I mean, they inhabit an utterly different world than the rest of us. And that's where I spent my time with Ted.
And how do you put that all down in a coherent form? And obviously you met up with Hugh, you combined these to put together the book, Ted Bundy, The Only Living Witness.
Well, so that the writing was a challenge, because I'm a journalist and I'm used to writing in the third person, like everybody is. And when I finally sat down with my editor and I said, okay, here's what we got, and she said, you have to write this in the first person. You can't write it in the third person. You're a character in the book. And I hadn't written in the first person since I'd written Home for Money when I was in college. And my every instinct was not to write in the first person, but I had to. And so the book is a chronicle of Ted Bundy, of his, you know, a repertorial chronicle, but it's also a memoir, if you will, an incredibly intense and unnerving episode in my life. Spending 6 months on a nearly daily basis in a hot, enclosed room out in the middle of nowhere, surrounded by prisoners and guards, while this guy is telling you about what it's like to rip somebody's head off, is not good for your balance.
Have you still got the tapes, by the way? Have you still got the tapes that you made? Do you keep them?
Oh, yeah. They were the basis of a series that just ran on Netflix called Conversations with a Killer.
Mm-hmm.
We still have, I mean, some of them, you know, they're 30 and 40 years old now, and some of them, you know, aren't as clear as they were because we didn't take good care of them. But, yeah, they're still got them.
I mean,
most of them.
I was going to think, because, I mean, if you turn them on now, does it take you back to that room? And can you hear it? And does it still make you go through the same feelings that you had 30, 40 years ago with Bundy?
Yeah. It's a little bit like pushing a button that has long been hidden. I had played the tapes over the years every now and again because detectives would want to hear them, and we did a couple of documentaries, but just, you know, short little things. This I had to sit and listen to the whole thing again and recreate what went on in that jail cell, that prison room. And I had to you had to relive it. You can't say, well, gee, I don't remember any of that, because you do. And, you know, and so the book is called The Only Living Witness, and I sometimes think that I'm the one who's the only living witness, and not yet. But, it was an unpleasant, very, very unpleasant experience, but necessary if we were going to get it told right.
So what do you hope that people will take from The Only Living Witness, your book on Ted Bundy? Is it a look into a completely warped, different, narcissistic way of a man's life? What do you hope? Is it a real heart looking into the heart of darkness? What do you hope that people will gather from the book?
Well, it's interesting. Men who I talk to sort of focus on how on earth did he do it? I mean, because a good number of the abductions and murders were very daring, very dangerous. I mean, a lot of chances to be caught. He took a lot of risks. He often was, drugged up or drunk when he committed these crimes. And I think to some extent, men, at least some, sort of look at what Ted did and said, is that the logical or illogical extension of what I feel? Because, Ted is classified as what they call a lust killer. And it certainly was a marriage of sex and violence, no doubt about it. Women think about it completely differently. I should have expected this, but it still was a revelation, because giving a young woman my book is like giving a book about deer hunting to Bambi. They're victims. They're victim class. I mean, I never once worried about, as I said, being Ted's victim. But any woman of a certain age certainly has to and could easily imagine the possibility of being abducted. Having too many of his victims were just walking along and he clubbed them over the head, or were in bed and had no inkling of what was about to happen to them. So my readers divide into two groups according to sex. The only subgroup that is hard to understand is the number of women who write me and tell me of encounters that they had with Ted Bundy where he, in some cases, attacked them, and it was physically impossible. They were just making up fantasies and calling me or writing me and telling me, what it was like to be a Ted Bundy victim when it was all in their imagination. And I still get these communications from women who are now in their 70s and 80s, who want the world to think that they, that Ted Bundy attacked them.
Disturbing, as is the book. The book is called Ted Bundy, The Only Living Witness. It's out now on Mirror Books. It's by Stephen Michaud and Hugh Ainsworth. Stephen, after writing this one, and you have a normal day job, I presume, making an honest living as a journalist, what are you up to next?
I've got a book about a dead cowboy down in Texas that I'm working on.
Right, okay.
It's a little bit more routine, but it's interesting. So save your dimes and nickels, and it'll be out, I hope, in a year or two.
Well, I look forward to reading that. And I don't often say this, but there are some interviews you do that leave a chill and an unease. And I think just listening to you and talking to you about being with Bundy, I'm going to have a long, hard look and a look around before I go to bed tonight, I think.
Well, look under your bed. Always look under your bed.
The book is called Ted Bundy, The Only Living Witness. It's by Stephen Marcho and Hugh Ainsworth. Stephen, thank you so much for your time today.
You're entirely welcome. It was, I won't say it was a pleasure, but it was interesting talking with you.